So how did you come to Northampton?
How did I come to Northampton?
That's I think where we have to
Yeah,
start.
1968. It was that old way that women used to travel, following my husband. I had been a student at Cornell. We had three children, ages by then 6, 9, and 12. Charles was hired to teach economics at Smith, and we moved here and lived in a Smith College faculty house the first 3 years, right above what is now the new athletic complex. It was a great place to raise kids.
Can you tell me a little bit about what Northampton was like then?
We looked at Amherst and Northampton. I mean, Northampton was obviously the most convenient because we could be close to his work, but I had really thought I'd like to go to UMass because at Cornell I had been studying physical anthropology. And they had that at UMass and they didn't have that at Smith. So I said, well, maybe we should live in Amherst. So we looked at Amherst and then we looked at Northampton. And we loved Northampton because it was, if I could say that, this regular people lived there. It wasn't just academics, you know? And we wanted our kids to be raised in a community that had a little bit more diversity. And there were people who worked in factories and farmers, and it was a good, New England diverse kind of a community. And we loved the way it looked also. We loved the wide downtown. From the very beginning, we felt at home with that. In those days, there were urban problems. Urban renewal had hit the country like a plague. And Ithaca, where we'd been living, and Austin, where we had grown up, had succumbed to some of the urban renewal ideas of raising the wonderful old buildings and leaving empty parking lots, which is what pretty much happened. Well, Northampton had not done that. And so it seemed like a downtown that had a lot of integrity architecturally. But still, there were very few buildings that didn't have boarded up second floors. And not long after we came, Newbury's, which was a kind of a mid-range department store, closed. And a few other locally owned stores closed. So it was a downtown that still was viable, but shaky, I would say. And then McCallum's department store, where Thorne's is now, closed. And that was a big, big change. But it was still always vibrant. In the early days, it had a larger Puerto Rican community downtown than it does now. The post office was on Pleasant Street. And very rarely did you go by in the evening when there weren't a whole lot of Puerto Ricans sitting, singing. It was much more vibrant. I think it changed really because of prejudice, honestly. And they were sort of relegated to Hampshire Heights and Florence Heights. And but we liked that. We liked that there were Puerto Ricans, people speaking Spanish, and we got very interested in 1970 in some of the old vacant buildings, like the roundhouse, that now is something.
Yes.
It was an empty railroad building, and a lot of other examples like that. So our kids, well, two of them went to the Smith College campus school, which in those days, if you were on the faculty, it was very inexpensive. And one went to Hawley Junior High, and then they all were in the public schools after grade school. We thought the schools were fine. They were a little crowded, and that was before John F. Kennedy Junior High was built, I think. Mm. Holly was the junior high. So it was a community that was active. We were against the Vietnam War. We had worked hard in various movements, and Northampton was a place you could find like-minded people. Mm-hmm. Some of them were at Smith, not that many, but some. Right. And Smith became a much more active, politically active place during the years we were here and afterward, I'm happy to say. So it was beautiful. We had a lot heavier winters in those days. I can remember in the winter we living on Belmont Avenue next to Smith and having snows that you couldn't drive in at all, and all of us walking downtown, you know, on paths people had shoveled, and the whole town being shut down. If you could imagine, Northampton mostly shut because of snow. It was a small town with a lot of opportunities, it felt like, for children to grow up with what felt like a real world, though of course it was very sheltered compared to, say, New York City. Mm-hmm. But it was less sheltered than Amherst, I would say.
Right.
I don't remember when I heard about the state hospital. I suppose fairly soon after we moved here. I didn't know anything about it except it was what in Texas we had called an insane asylum. Mm-hmm. That was the old word for it. And that it was kind of an awful place. That was the image that I had. That people didn't get much treatment, that it was a holding facility. I didn't really know any of this for sure, but that was the image I had. And that anybody who had any choice at all would not go there. Mm-hmm. What else I knew about it was that my children loved, all three of them, to sled down Hospital Hill.
I did that when I was a kid.
Right, exactly. Uh-huh. The fabulous sledding hill.
Totally.
And in the summer, they would play there, too. They played because we lived so close to it. We lived practically at the base of it. And they enjoyed it a whole lot. And I imagine they explored up in there some that we didn't know about. We hadn't forbidden it, but there were certainly fences and things. And as far as I know, they never had any negative experiences with it. It was huge. It seemed huge. If you'd go up Route 66 and look on either side, very sort of impenetrable looking, the old buildings felt that way. But that was purely, just a kind of intuitive thing. I didn't really know. One of my children loved horses, John, and the horse stables were right across the street from Hospital Hill and just down from some of the other buildings from the state hospital. So he used to go there. So it was always kind of part of the landscape, I would guess you would say, and a place where, I mean, I knew people who worked there, I guess. Mm-hmm. They were, it employed an awful lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I knew that people went there from all over this part of the state. That's about all I knew. When I started learning more about it was in 1973, when I started working, 1974, 5, and early 76, when I started working for the state's Office for Children. Mm. That was an advocacy office for kids. And and I supervised people who were advocates for children in all over Western Massachusetts. And we tracked we did a sort of case management approach. So we tracked individual children. And one of the problems had been that kids had been sent to institutions inappropriately. And in those days, there were very few community-based services, very few. So if you didn't have any money, where else were you going to go? And children had been put, and adults, had been put in the Belchertown State Hospital as, quote, retarded, who weren't. They were troublemakers in the family, supposedly. Or the family just couldn't afford that many children. And they were not treated well. There are lots of there's a lot of documentation about that for Belchertown State School, for example. And I knew about Belchertown because I'd also had been working as an advocate for organic agriculture and small farms. And we started a school for small organic farmers on the grounds of the Belchertown State Hospital at the old school farm called the New England Small Farm Institute, which is still there. So I'd met the superintendent, Bill Jones, and we became friends. And so I learned a lot about what was happening in there, and he was a reformer. This was about the time that Jerry Miller was made commissioner of the Department of Youth Services. Frank Sargent was governor, and he and his wife Jessie got very concerned about what was happening in these institutions. And it began with the juvenile detention centers, and then the places like Belchertown for so-called retarded, and then the state hospitals where so-called mentally ill people were put. It sort of spread like that, this sense that we had that people in these institutions were not being well served, to say the least, that there was a lot of political graft that went on, that a lot of legislators were using these state institutions as places to pay back political favors by creating what were called no-show jobs. You'd get one of the jobs and you never had to show up and you got a paycheck. And that happened through these institutions a lot. So there were places where, I mean, in Belchertown, people would be lined up, wheelchairs, you know, taken out of their beds and hosed down, literally hosed down and left, you know, to dry or whatever. Not fed well, tied up terribly. So there was this reform movement that went on. This was in the early 70s. This was like 73, 2, 3, 4, 5, right in there. The state hospital, there had been some things that had been happening at the state hospital that people were concerned about, though they had some very caring people on the staff. So working for the Office for Children, I was working at a level where I was calling meetings of people from these various institutions about individual children. And children went to age 21 or 22. So some of these were in the state hospital. And so I knew a good many of the staffers and the heads of these institutions. So when my own son, who had had a lot of emotional difficulty from really about age 15 to 16, I would say, became violent and tried to take his own life a couple of times and seemed to be aggressive toward others, or at least acting out in ways that frightened other patients. And I was a single mom by then and had no savings whatsoever, but I did have insurance, health insurance, Blue Cross. Well, he was, if you were over 18, you couldn't be under your parents' health insurance, so he wasn't being covered. And so I couldn't get him into McLean's, for example, or Brattleboro Retreat, which had better reputations. But after the second time he tried to take his own life, his psychiatrist said, if you don't put him in a place where he can be safe, he's going to succeed. And the only place there is that will take somebody who's violent is the state hospital. It was the hardest decision I had ever made in my life to allow him to go there. He actually liked it. He felt that he could be as crazy as he was there. And he said that to me, and I knew what he meant by that. But at the same time, it was an awful place. He wasn't getting treatment. And even his psychologist sort of left on vacation. I mean, he was really abandoned a lot of the time. And so at the same time, I knew about some of this reform movement that was going on. It hadn't really hit the state hospital yet. And then when Bill was there, I had just found, I had gone to Boston on the bus. I don't think we had a car then. And had gone to the Office for Children meeting that I was slated for and gone to the Blue Cross office and gotten them. I had heard that maybe they could pay for him if he had been declared disabled, emotionally disabled, which he had been. He was on DSS. And so I said, and you will pay for him to go to McLean's? Well, if these things are true and so on, yes. I had told him the night before I was going to be doing this and that I was hopeful, you know, that maybe we could get him out of the state hospital. And it was while I was on my way home on the bus from Boston that he hung himself. So he knew that he might get out. And it was, you know, partly for that reason is, I mean, it was like, it's hard to, I can't feel it right now or I wouldn't even be able to talk about it. But it was really, really hard. And when he died, and it was handled just horribly by a phone call, and I never saw him. And my lawyer, who was a good friend, who definitely an advocate, really wanted to sue the state for not checking on him often enough and leaving him with something that he could hang himself with and so on. And I just didn't have the heart for it. I felt that there was neglect, I thought. I also thought they were working under really horrible conditions. The staff that I knew that were the direct care staff were, for the most part, really doing their best. And I felt that it was a real choice that he made. And I don't know if I would choose these days. I might go ahead and push it. But I was emotionally not in a place to do that. I felt so guilty myself that I somehow hadn't been able to save him. And however, his death spurred the work by a number of people to shut down that hospital. And it sort of just gave them, it inspired them somehow. They're friends of mine. And to become involved in the deinstitutionalization effort. And I watched on the sidelines, you know, I couldn't get in. I just, still emotionally, I couldn't even work anymore for a whole year, because I would have had to work with the very people I felt he did let him down, and the people at a higher level that had not responded with some resources that they could have. And so I just was so angry. I was just incredibly angry. But it was a place, the state hospital. He was in Hasbrook House, which was the Hampshire County place. There were maybe Berkshire people were there, I don't remember. It was divided into counties. And his was the most modern, up to date, I guess. And the coldest. It was very cold and stark, I guess you would say. Nothing about it was anything but institutional. And people were encouraged to go to the rec room and smoke, drink coffee, and eat candy bars out of the machines, which, as we now know, is some of the worst, you know, encouragement for emotional imbalance from people who aren't even ill. Mm-hmm. So there was that kind of just gross, try to keep them quiet, you know, keep them on Thorazine. There's not much hope, you know, maybe they'll luck out and come through this. It was that sort of a thing. And it was not a place you would happily have put anybody. I'm not saying anybody that I knew was, like, punished or mistreated in that way, but they were neglected, and they were given things that were not in their best interest by default. I mean, that's all there was for them, were smoking, rocking, eating candy bars, and drinking coffee. That was it, pretty much. And so when he died, I couldn't even drive up Route 66 for several years. I just couldn't do it. It was like something lived there that I couldn't be near. Grief, I guess. And that about a year later, the children and I were able to sell our house in Northampton and move to the woods, which was very therapeutic for all of us, the land, and that's where I still am. 28 years this September. So he died in February of 1976, which is 30 years ago now, this last February. And it took a few years for them to close it down. And I think a lot of people were hurt in that because the programs that were set up, some were really good, and so some people really lucked out. But there were other people who were just let out, and they had no job, and they had no money, and they had a room with a bare light bulb, and that's all they had. Mm. And I met a number of those people. And I didn't blame them for going back to drinking or whatever it was they had been keeping themselves alive doing, because they had nothing at all. So it was a time of great ferment, and it was almost like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. I think a lot of the programs now are quite good. I think there's been a lot of progress made in the treatment of bipolar disorders and schizophrenia, and it's still a terrible problem, but it's a lot better. People can live a lot better lives now with treatment than they did, and there are places that are humane and clean and supervised, but, you know, there's no perfect solution except to regain your balance somehow in your life. And that's like grace.